And PERS is an obvious choice, right? Such a huge problem, not only in this country, but in other huge swine producing countries around the world. It causes very severe systemic infections. And if you look at, again, on the human side, where there's been a lot of work done with vitamin D, their work would suggest that, hey, vitamin D may help kind of regulate an immune response, a systemic immune response. And so it may help people or animals to get through that infection a little bit easier than if, you know, they're deficient in it.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production. You can combat mycotoxins in your feed with Fumezyme from DSM Firmenich. Fumezyme is the only FDA-approved enzyme to degrade fumonisins. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Eastman works with you to accelerate your nutritional program innovation. Start your journey with us at eastman.com. Healthier pigs are good for producers, people, profits, and planet.
Hello, and welcome to the Swine It podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host today, and I have two guests with me, Dr. Michael Ray and Kelly Grace Keene, both with North Carolina State University. Dr. Ray is an associate professor of immunology at North Carolina State, and Kelly Grace is a graduate student in population, health, and pathobiology at North Carolina State University. Her research focuses on feeding of animals for enhanced disease resistance and recovery, specifically the effect of vitamin D on viral infection outcomes in the pig. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Tara.
Thank you.
So today we're going to discuss your research on the effects of vitamin D and PERS virus immunity. But before we get started, I would like you guys to introduce yourself to our audience, tell a little bit about how you got here. Dr. Ray, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I think you were a little bit generous, actually. You may have inadvertently promoted me. So I'm an assistant professor here at NC State. But that's totally fine. So I came here about a year and a half ago. And I came here from Iowa State. I had the wonderful opportunity to train there in anatomic pathology and work in the diagnostic lab there with a lot of really great individuals, learned from them. And just through that process, developed a lot of, you know, research questions along the way, one of which we'll talk about here today. I made the move with my family to North Carolina. My wife's a NC State alum, and I've been enjoying my year and a half here and just dedicated on research mainly.
Great. Thank you. And Kelly Grace, tell us about you.
Sure. So I'm from the dark side. I am a poultry person. My parents grow turkeys, and I got my bachelor's and master's in the poultry science department here at NC State. And then I worked for a few years in the industry. And it was during that time that I realized having a PhD would really help me accelerate into the career paths that I'm interested in. So I hunted down for a little bit, met Mike. It seemed to work out fine. And that's how I ended up in his lab, and it seems to be going okay, so I've been told.
Great. Well, I'm glad that he invited you to our show, and certainly interested. I love having guests that have, something different than swine, because we all need to learn from each other. So I think that's important, especially, in food production. So welcome.
Thank you.
Great. Well, let's get started on our discussion. Dr. Ray, why don't you start us off in sharing your thoughts on why vitamin D and its effect on PERS?
Yeah. I talked about it there at the intro, but, when I was at Iowa State as a diagnostician there in the diagnostic lab, it was a disease, a disease that we saw, right? So you'd see metabolic bone disease cases, you test serum looking at 25-hydroxy. And so that piece we kind of understood, but there were some cases where, especially when you see just oddball kind of opportunistic infections, and sometimes testing the vitamin D in those pigs, you'd come up with really low values. And that was always kind of a question I think we had, was how big of a role does vitamin D play, not just in, the musculoskeletal system, but in immunity. And it also, it got brought up in our research there. We were working with Kansas State, the nutrition group over there, on some metabolic bone disease questions with Jordan Gephardt and Bo Williams. And they did a study out in the field, and they looked at, you know, what they considered normal and then sick pigs and vitamin D levels in those pigs. And the sick pigs had lower levels. And the question became very chicken and egg, right? Well, did the vitamin D cause them to be sick, or, you know, did they go off feed and that's why their levels are low? And so that was always kind of in the back of my mind. And then when we made the move over here, it was something that I really wanted to investigate and do it, you know, in a way that mattered. That's one of the things we talk about in our lab is really, you know, our research questions have to matter. If they don't, then we probably shouldn't be asking them, right? Or we should refocus our efforts. And so again, we got here, one of the kind of arms of my lab is really focused on how do we better prepare animals for infection and then also for disease recovery, right? And vitamin D is in the human side has been suggested to play a role in immunity to a large degree. And a lot of that really hasn't been worked out. They're still trying to figure a lot of that out. They're a little bit limited on the human side, right? Just because, you know, they can't run controlled studies. Obviously they can do a lot of in vitro stuff that may suggest that it does this or that. But they don't have the ability to obviously take a population and really control, all the things that you need to control to really determine how vitamin D affects, you know, viral disease outcomes. The beauty of the pig is we have that ability. And so we got here, we partnered with DSM and so we had the vitamin D component. The next side was, you know, what's going to be our infectious disease challenge model. And PERS is an obvious choice, right? Such a huge problem, not only in this country, but in other huge swine producing countries around the world. It causes very severe systemic infections. And if you look at, again, on the human side, where there's been a lot of work done with vitamin D, their work would suggest that, hey, vitamin D may help kind of regulate an immune response, a systemic immune response. And so it may help people or animals to get through that infection a little bit easier than if, you know, they're deficient in it. And, you know, I think the other piece was there was a paper in 2013 that came out of, I believe it was Canada, where they actually set up the pig as a model to evaluate the effect of vitamin D on immunity. And so they fed pigs to three different levels of vitamin D, you know, low industry levels and then supplemented. And they very generally evaluated the immune response to those three levels of vitamin D. And so looking at things like, you know, numbers of specific white blood cells in the blood or in alveolar lavages, and then also looking at the ability of those cells to function, right? And so with macrophages, their ability to basically eat things or phagocytose them. And so it's a really interesting paper. But with that, there was kind of the piece of, but it doesn't matter, right? And so on our end, we really wanted to take kind of that model and then apply PERS to it and really see, you know, does vitamin D immunity matter when it comes to a really severe systemic infection and disease like PERS does.
Kelly Grace, do you want to add about your specific research in this role?
Yes. Like Mike mentioned, the project we finished back in May was kind of inspired by that 2013 paper. We had a similar dietary treatment setup. We had a marginal, which had a lower vitamin D, total vitamin D in the diet. We had what was considered the industry standard. And then we had a supplemented diet, which included just normal vitamin D as well as the 25-hydroxy vitamin D3. And those pigs were reared on the diet for about 3 weeks. And then at day post-challenge zero, we challenged them with PERS. We took them out until 14 days post-challenge. And throughout the entire trial, we took body weights, we did temp scores, we collected blood for PBMC isolation for some cellular work. And then we had a final necropsy where there was growth scoring of the lungs, some histopathology. And Mike can talk about that a bit more as the pathologist. But we're still working on analyzing quite a few of those samples. But I think there's some initial good information, especially with the antibody response. So we looked at just general PERS specific antibody titers at day 14, as well as neutralizing antibodies. And it seems like there's a trend where the supplemented diet does have a better antibody response as far as higher titers. But at day 14, I think it was cut off a little short. So maybe in the future we could extend it to another week or so to fully see how the antibody response differs between the different dietary treatments.
Yeah, I think all that's good stuff. I think, you know, one of the other pieces too is we were very fortunate with this study. We wanted to have, you know, the funding that we did from DSM to take a look at this and have their help with it, right? Sarah Huff was awesome and super helpful throughout the study. Their group's been great to work with. And then also, I mean, the big one here is, you know, we can do the pathology work and the animal work, but we needed a nutritionist, right? That's one thing we absolutely can't do. And so Eric Van Houten and his group, they have been fantastic. And that was one of the big questions we had with this, right? Kind of setting up, you know, what would really be, 4 to 6 weeks of pigs on low to industry to high levels of vitamin D. It's like, well, are we going to get there? Are we going to get there? And then how are those animals going to respond? And Eric nailed it. He nailed it all the way through. And so he was from, you know, formulating the diets to making sure, I mean, I'm feed drop off day that Friday, remember he showed up and was there helping us, you know, making sure that we were implementing everything the way we should. So very thankful for the collaborators that we had on this project for sure.
Pigs are constantly threatened by the exposure of mycotoxins in their feed. Fumonisins are a highly prevalent mycotoxin that can impact health and performance. DSM Firmenich offers a range of analytical services to assess mycotoxin contamination and solutions to combat mycotoxins. One of these solutions is Fumezyme, the only FDA-approved enzyme to combat fumonisins. Visit dsmfirmenich.com/fumezyme to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds really interesting and some great stuff because PRRS does bring out the worst in the pig in terms of disease. And it really, to speak to your, you know, longevity, the time, you know, PRRS is a long systemic infection and it affects the immune system. You know, I think sometimes on those young pigs for life, right? And so it's really important stuff, and that disease is just devastating. So tell me about the study. How many days prior to the PRRS infection would you have had them on the diets? So dig into the details just a little bit in terms of I'm an old practitioner, and so you know how I'm thinking to myself, how long do I need to have these pigs sort of in advance, or you know, when we start to see clinical signs or know they are at high risk of seroconverting or getting infected, do we put it in then? So tell me a little bit about what your thoughts are on practical application. And I know you aren't finished, right? But we all want to know out there listening, you know, what's some insight?
So it was pretty interesting because all of the pigs used, they were taken from a variety of sows. So it wasn't just, you know, one or two. I think it was like 4 or 5 different sows. So they were weaned around 3 weeks. Some were a few days younger, some were a few days older. And then once they were weaned, they were assigned to their diet. And it was a little over 3 weeks, I'm pretty sure, that they were just reared. They were just fed on the diet. There was no challenge. They were housed together. So it was around that time. And then they were continually fed the diet during the PRRS study as well. So it would be interesting to see if you could just feed the, you know, different dietary or different diets to begin with, and then infect with PRRS and switching to a normal diet for all the pigs, and seeing if there is a sustained effect from the early feeding compared to just continually feeding throughout. I think that's a few steps ahead from where we are right now, but that would be interesting to think about, because especially with the supplemented group, you know, you're paying for whatever, you know, the higher vitamin D or whatever supplement that you're using, and it's expensive. And like Mike said, you know, we want our research to be applicable and to be something that the industry is truly interested in and is a treatment or a solution that they would actually use. And it's, so I think that would be an interesting spinoff from where we're at right now.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff in there, Kelly Grace. I think, you know, the flip side of that, it would be really interesting as well as we continue to analyze here. And if we're showing that there is sustained benefit to have higher levels of vitamin D, you know, let's start pigs on the same levels of vitamin D, infect them with PRRS, and then supplement and not right? So once we have that PCR positive and we know they're infected, if we add in vitamin D in whatever form, if you want to do it in the diet or maybe you want to put it in water, what does that do to recovery? Does that improve recovery? You know, is that going to enhance their immunity? What's it going to do? I think that's a really important question. And we're getting into next steps here early, but that's the exciting part, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And you took one of my questions, and that was, what about using, you know, a combination of feed and water, right? Because we can be out in the field, we can be more nimble, right, with the water supplementation, maybe than a diet change and delivery. So, you took my next question. So it sounds like maybe some next steps, right, in what you're doing. So tell me, when do you think some of your work will be finished? What's your target, and what would happen next? When can we find this out in the industry?
The study's done. The study was completed back in spring, but it's doing the lab work that, you know, it takes quite a bit of time, and just ordering all the supplies, having the supplies back ordered, just takes a long time. So ideally, and I'm not an optimist, but ideally I was going to have everything done by the end of this year. And I don't think that's going to happen anymore. So I would say more realistically by summer of 2025 is hopefully when we would be able to publish and have the results, all of the results from this study out for everyone to read.
Yeah, I think, you know, a huge bulk of the work is done. Our pathology is done. The PCRs are done. You know, all of the kind of the clinical stuff has been completed. The antibody work with JQ Zhang's group at Iowa State has been completed, right? They've been fantastic. But there's pieces that we need to wrap up, right? And the stuff that just takes a while. So, you know, Kelly Grace has done a fantastic job on the T cell characterization piece. But we're about halfway into that. It takes a while because you were dealing with live cells and they're a little bit finicky. And so in order to make sure that those results are clean, you know, you have to do it in a very controlled, time sensitive manner. And so it takes a little bit. You know, the other side is with all of our research, right? It has to matter, but we also want to be innovative in what we do. And so with that, we're doing some work, not only looking at live cells in blood, but also in the lung, which is kind of a new area, surprisingly, that we're getting into with PRRS immunity. But also trying to correlate that with evaluation of fixed lung sections. So we love the spatial ability that HistoPath gives us, but, you know, can we use some of the new tools that are out there to actually evaluate the immune cells that are in those HistoPath sections? And so that's another piece that will probably take the longest of anything, just because it's newer and we're going to have to work out bugs in order to, you know, get really nice clean results out of it. And so that stuff, yeah, it tends to take a little bit longer. And then other pieces, you know, that come up too, right? So that's kind of the fun, you know, maybe not so much fun part of research, right? And I think, you know, to point back to the antibody response that Kelly Grace talked about earlier, right? So that's been the biggest difference that we've seen, I guess, based on diet, right? So just our seroconversion, our PRRS virus IgM, PRRS virus IgG, and then also our neutralizing response. It looks like if they're marginal in vitamin D, those levels tend to be lower than if they're sufficient or if they're supplemented. And at day 14, you know, that's still early. And so it really brings up the question of, well, what happens if you take this out two more weeks, right? If that trend holds, do those animals recover quicker? And then I think the big question with that, if that trend holds, what does that look like in terms of response to an MLV? You know, if a pig that's on a marginal vitamin D diet gets vaccinated compared to a pig that's supplemented or on an industry level, is that supplemented industry level pig going to respond better to that vaccine and then be more resistant to challenge down the road? I think that's a huge question that would be really interesting to get into. And so as we continue to move towards the end of this study, you know, doing our best to make sure that we investigate it fully, we'll start to transition to some of those, I think, really important questions.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, we know there's, I think there's enough your study that you mentioned earlier that was sort of the basis for going forward with this and digging in deeper, right? We know there's an effect with vitamin D, and there's an interaction, but getting to the cellular level and even into the lung level, right? That's the difference that I see in what we don't know. It's kind of this hypothetical of we think it helps, but you're proving that, and that's really exciting. So, those of us out here will be patient because that kind of work takes time.
Yeah. And I think, just one more thought on it too, Tara, with the immune response and kind of the evaluation of it, I feel like we tend to judge it in the same way we judge what we know about anatomy, right? Of like, we know all these things about anatomy and physiology. Why don't we know this about the immune system, right? Like, why are we so far behind? And the reality is, like, we are very, very new to understanding the immune system. And in large part, that's just due to the lack of tools that we've had for so many years, right? And so now, because we've had really good people that came before us and have really worked on PERS, now we're able to understand how to isolate cells out of the lung better than what, a lot of people were before. We're able to utilize some of these different tools from different disciplines like pathology, just because they didn't exist 5 years ago, right? And so it's really kind of an exciting time for us, because we think it allows us to get to the tissues that really matter and figure out, what our immune response is doing in those tissues. And hopefully through that, we'll be able to kind of blaze a trail towards hopefully better therapeutics, better vaccines, and again, hopefully get a better handle on PERS here in the future.
Yeah, great. I think you're exactly right. We're still learning, and there's a lot of immune even cells specifically that we didn't know about when I was in school. So, and that's not even what they do and how they work and all of the other factors, right? So, one of my old mentors, Dr. Eileen Thacker, told me one time when I was asking her about vaccine and the response, she said, "Tara, you're very underestimating the immune response here." And so I always remember that, because there's a lot we don't know and maybe we assume, but I love research like this to actually learning and getting into it so we do know. So great. Well, so we're rounding out our time. Is there any last thoughts on your research project or this area that you want to share with the audience as take homes?
So we've been talking about PERS because obviously we challenged with PERS, and it's one of the most predominant pathogens in swine, in the swine industry, which is the first fact that I learned when I switched from poultry to swine. But I think it's important to understand that, hopefully this research can expand into other pathogens such as swine flu, maybe non-viral pathogens as well. But for right now, we're staying as focused as we can be. And then from the results that we hopefully will get, we can then expand out. But I think that's an important bookmark to have.
Yeah, very good point, because there's a lot of other pathogens besides PERS, right? And even maybe just the immune system and growth, right, of a normal pig, right, that gets exposed to, strep, right? All those pathogens that are a bit endemic.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point, Kelly Grace. And with that too, right, if we look at the vaccine or vaccination component, the number of shots that our piglets get and our breeding stock get, right, if vitamin D does play a role in our ability to generate an antibody response, right? Now it's like you said, beyond just PERS, it's into every single vaccine that animal gets, right? Hopefully improving that so that we develop better responses.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at fortivaimpact.com. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Trial Nutrition North America, everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Essential Ag Solutions, bringing innovative science-based solutions to livestock producers. Keys Manufacturing is America's number one source for cheese meal and dairy powders for your feed. Check us out at keysmanufacturing.com.
Well, if you have any further questions or comments for our guests, Dr. Michael Ray or Kelly Grace Keene, please shout out on your podcast platform They'll be able to help you, and we're excited to hear about your research, Kellyanne, and when you get it all finished. Appreciate you guys being with me today. If you liked our podcast, give us a thumbs up on your platform. But before we end, we ask our guests a few questions at the end just to get to know them a little bit better. And so we'll start off here, Kelly Grace, with the first question is, what's your favorite book or resource that you use in your area of expertise?
There's not a lot of, you know, hard copy books that I use nowadays, but the resource that I use the most for my research is definitely YouTube, because there's so many useful tutorials on any assay, any principle. I use it a lot when I took immunology last semester. Even our last lab meeting, Mike pulled up a YouTube video of some technology that you could use in the field. So I think really utilizing YouTube, not just for binge watching, you know, fun videos, but actually as a learning tool, I think is really useful. So that's definitely what I use the most.
That's funny, because I YouTube, you know, how to change a setting on my iPhone all the time, because my kids aren't living with me anymore. And so that's great. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Mike, how about you? What's a resource or book?
That is a great one. You know, classically diseases of swine, right? It's such a good resource. But people, I think, are probably the biggest one, you know, and it doesn't have to be, you know, specific to swine. I think one of the really neat things that we can do as swine focused people is bring in other people that have expertise that would help us, right, to answer some of our big questions. And so finding those people, I think, is really exciting. And then just kind of letting them see your enthusiasm for the problem and hopefully getting them excited about it too, is maybe one way to kind of bring them in. But yeah, there is no shortage of things that you can learn from your peers.
Yeah, no, that's great. So how about something outside of ag or immunity or swine health? Any other insights to a favorite book or place that you go, Kelly Grace, for you know, even a hobby?
Yeah. So, I definitely have a favorite place that I go, quite a few. Raleigh is very blessed with a lot of outdoor greenway spaces. And I'm a runner, not a good runner, but I am a runner at 5'2". So the art museum is right down the road from, the vet school. It's like maybe a minute drive. And so I go there quite a bit, especially when I have an awkward like hour and a half incubation period for something in the lab. And it's just really nice. It's very beautiful just to get some fresh air, get some sunlight, especially now that the time has changed and the sun's only out for 30 minutes every day. So definitely the art museum, I think, is my favorite place to go.
How about you, Mike?
Sometimes I feel bad reading things that aren't science related, right? Because you feel like you're using mental space on something where you could be kind of working on your discipline. But yeah, I love to read, especially nonfiction. And I don't know if there's a specific one that comes to mind right now. I'm about halfway through Undaunted Courage, which is kind of the story behind Lewis and Clark. And so that's been really interesting. I think they're kind of American legends, right? We think of them and you're like, oh my gosh, like they traversed the entire continent and then came back. It's incredible. But I think the biggest takeaway from reading that book has been not only their courage to do what they did and to make it work, but also the mistakes that they made. I think sometimes we tend to think that people like that never made mistakes and, you know, we're unique in our ability to blunder, but it's kind of neat to read their story and also realize that they made a lot of mistakes, but continued to work through it and got there in the end.
Yeah, really interesting. And I think, you know, we can use some of that advice that, you know, that's how we learn as well, right? Make mistakes, but start over or learn from them. So yeah, good message. So last but not least, the last question is, share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful people apart from others.
So Mike, it's so funny you mentioned the mistakes of Lewis and Clark, because I definitely think that being able to realize your shortcomings is one of the best characteristics to have in the workplace or at school or anywhere, because it if you think that you already know everything and you think that you're the best at everything, there's no room for growth and there's no interest in growing. And you end up missing out on a lot of opportunities. And you also end up usually making more mistakes because you don't think that you have any growth to have. So I think just realizing what your shortcomings are and being able to reach out to people and your peers to help fill in those shortcomings is what separates a decent professional from a very successful one.
Yeah, very good advice.
Yeah, geez, I don't know if I've got one better than that. Maybe that's my shortcoming here. Yeah, it's so true. I think communication is huge too, and I think, you know, it's something I'm constantly working on because I definitely know I'm not the best at it, but just understanding ways in which to communicate with, you know, with your colleagues, with your peers, with those that work with you, and you know, trying to do that in a way that draws the team together in a really positive way. Constant work in progress on that. But when it's done right, it really helps to, you know, alleviate concerns. It helps to foster teamwork. It helps to build confidence. And I think those are huge for any successful team. And so, effective communication, I would say would be a very, very positive attribute.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's what we're here for, right, is to communicate with our guests and with our audience on what you guys are up to and meet some new people that are doing really great work. So I appreciate you guys' time today. I hope you have a great rest of your day and can't wait to hear your research results, Kelly Grace, when you get those published.
I'm very excited.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.